Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State v. Joshua W. Nolan. Mr. Wilson, good morning to you. You may approach. You may proceed. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel to the State, Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Joshua Nolan. Mr. Nolan's appealing from his convictions of first-degree murder associated counts. One of the things I'd like to open with this morning, if I may, there's actually been three issues conceded by the State in this case, three issues which the State acknowledges should have been granted evidentiary hearing in this post-conviction motion. I'm not going to focus too much on those today unless the Court has any questions about those specifically. I think the first thing, though, I'd like to do is point out that in our reply, we did argue that several additional issues should have been granted evidentiary hearing, one of which, and the one I think is possibly the most interesting to this Court based on some of the precedent that I've looked at, is the issue of prosecutorial misconduct in closing arguments. If you read some of the statements that were made during closing, they relate directly to the integrity of not just defense counsel, but the entire profession of criminal defense attorneys. These comments were very specifically directed toward the job of defense lawyers. If you look at this case, this Court's precedent from Barfield, this Court made it very clear and found plain error when the prosecutor in that case said that defense lawyers, generally speaking, are liars. Now, they didn't use the word liar in this case, and I know the State's going to focus on that. But what they did do is they said that defense lawyers, it's their job to use smoke screens and I believe the other thing was mirrors in misleading the jury. Now,
did they say in misleading a jury?
Well, the prosecutor, there's two times when the first prosecutor came out during closing argument and said, this trial counsel, it was Mr. Stockman at the time, he's going to come out, he's going to use smoke screens and mirrors. And then
He's going to do smoke and mirrors.
Smoke and mirrors, yeah.
Okay.
And then on rebuttal argument, a different prosecutor, the other counsel for the State, came out and said, I'm paraphrasing. She said, trial counsel used smoke screen and mirrors to, and she didn't use the word mislead. She used the words to tell you things that didn't really happen. I'm going to explain what really happened here. And then she went through and purported to correct, misleading things that Mr. Stockman allegedly said in closing. Now, I went and looked through these arguments. I couldn't find where Mr. Stockman invited these comments by purposely misleading the jury or by, lying about something or mischaracterizing evidence. I didn't see any of that. So one of the factors that this Court will look at is, did defense counsel invite these comments? I think when the Court says that, I think what it's thinking is, did trial counsel mislead the jury in some way such that the comment would be an acceptable thing to say? In my book, these statements are not far removed from what we saw in Barfield, if at all removed. The only difference here is semantics. Because if you're telling a jury that this defense counsel came in and used smoke screen and mirrors to confuse or mislead you, and then you tell the jury on rebuttal, he sure did, these are all the ways he did it. I don't know. I think it's a little more misleading to make that comment in a rebuttal argument.
What if the prosecutor had used the term red herrings?
So distractions. Right. And that's the distinction here, right? That's the one that this Court's going to have to really examine is, was the prosecutor making an argument that the trial counsel was trying to distract the jury, which in most cases is going to be permissible depending on how it's done, or was the prosecutor making an argument that trial counsel job was to mislead them. Had the prosecutor used the word red herrings, I don't think it would have fit into what she was saying, or either of them were saying. Had the prosecutor used the word red herrings, it wouldn't have made much sense. There is a couple, and I have to credit, by the way, the court may have noticed in the procedural history of this case, I was hired after my client filed his own pro se appellant's brief in this case, and after the state had filed a response brief. He did an excellent job in his pro se post-conviction motion of looking at a few cases from out of state where the prosecutors had actually used the word smokescreen in an acceptable way. But they had used it to attack an argument, a specific argument, not, as the prosecutors did in this case, to attack defense counsel's job, the job of all criminal defense attorneys, and the, you know, and specifically trial counsel in this case. I think there's a big difference. And I think if you look at the statements, I know the words are different, and you compare them to what you saw in Barfield, a case where this court found plain error and remanded for a new trial despite the fact that there was no objection. I think this court, and I didn't say this in my reply brief, but I do believe that this court could find plain error right here, reverse and remand for a new trial now. It could, if it finds these statements rise to that level. That said, if it's not going to go that far, I think at the very least, we need an evidentiary hearing to determine, first of all, if trial counsel had some sort of, I guess, reasonable strategic reason, you know, for failing to object. That's one question the court's always interested in, I know. But I just can't think of any good strategic reason for not objecting to those comments and asking for a mistrial.
What if you like the looks of your jury? Isn't that a potential strategic reason?
And I did say in my reply brief that that might be, you know, I didn't say that specifically, but I said that trial counsel might have had a reason. So if this court deems that, you know, these statements don't rise to the level necessarily of what we saw in Barfield, but the court wants more information, the court wants the district court to get some facts on this, that makes sense, Your Honor. I won't stomp my feet, pull my hair out around if this court wants to see that.
It would be helpful if you could be a bit more specific as to exactly what the prosecutor said.
Right. So, clearly it's in the record. I'd have to read the comments a bit from here. But one of the things that the prosecutor did say, if I can find my... So, the prosecutor, in closing argument, said that she expected trial counsel to come up, to get up here and do the smoke screens and mirrors. So that's what the prosecutor in the closing argument said. During the rebuttal argument, the prosecutor came up in front of the jury.
Suppose she had merely said, you should listen very carefully and be very skeptical about what defense counsel is going about to say. Well, is that egregious?
The big difference between that and what the prosecutor did here is she also said, I'm sorry, she said if she expected him to get up because that's his job. And that was the part of the improper argument in Barfield that this court really zeroed in on. It said, okay, wait a minute. It's all right to argue that these are red herrings or that this is a, you know, I expect the court's going to, or trial counsel's going to do, you know, point to this and it as a distraction from what we're really looking at here. That's okay. And that's probably okay in this case, but that's not what happened in this case. The words, his job, appeared at least twice in reference directly to trial counsel misleading the jury using smoke screens and mirrors. And what are smoke screens and mirrors other than ways of misleading somebody? I don't consider that a distraction. If you're in a hall of mirrors, you're bumping into the mirrors because you're being misled by these false reflections, right? Or these reflections, you're banging into them. If it's a smoke screen, you're obscuring something. So words matter. If you're going to use words like smoke screens and mirrors, you better not be using them to impugn the integrity of trial counsel or the defense bar in general.
Are there any other claims? There are A to N that
right.
you want to mention on behalf of your client.
There are a lot of claims, Your Honor, obviously.
The strength of any others that you want to draw to the court's attention?
I think while I'm here, I'll just mention, first of all, you'll see in our reply brief, I focused in on the few that I believe this court should really look hard at in addition to those that were conceded. So those are the ones in my reply brief that I really argued out, and then I submitted some on the appellant's opening brief. One that I think the court should look at a little more closely is the introduction of the mugshots. We consider those mugshots, front and back mugshots. Although it's not a front profile, it's still very similar to what most people would consider to be a mugshot. He's wearing prison attire. That's a problem in our opinion. And we'd like to see remanded for evidentiary hearing to explore how that affected the trial.
What would come out at such a hearing?
Well, there is nothing prohibiting on part of an evidentiary hearing talking to jurors. So if we had the opportunity to speak to jurors, determine what happened there, as well as trial counsel, determine whether there was some strategy involved in not objecting to those. Those would be the two big evidentiary issues we'd like to explore. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lewis, good morning.
Honors, good morning. Wilson, please the court. On behalf of the athlete of the state of Nebraska, Mr. Nolan's post-conviction motion contains 14 claims of effective assistance of counsel set forth in our brief. None of those claims are procedurally barred, and we agree that an evidentiary hearing is warranted in the first three claims, but we maintain that an evidentiary hearing is not warranted in the remaining claims. I'm not going to rehash all the remaining claims or our responses, but I do want to focus on four claims that the appellant has focused on in his reply brief. I was going to take them in order, but in light of the prior discussion, I think I'll start with prosecutorial conduct or allegation of prosecutorial misconduct.
And that was letter J.
That corresponds with claim J, yes, you're correct.
Thank you.
I think I'll actually just start by reading the actual comments because I think we have some questions as to what was actually said here. The record verbatim is prosecutor number one during initial closings. So what do you have? What are the odds? Is this all just a mere coincidence? I mean, is the defense going to get up here and do the smoke screens and mirrors? I assume he will. That's his job. That's what he's supposed to do. He will get up here and try to pick apart every consistency with every witness. And I concede to you that there are inconsistencies. There's going to be inconsistencies.
So the thrust of that really is that the defense attorney is going to get up and point out inconsistencies in the testimony, and that's done all the time.
Right. So we would submit that these comments, when read in context, are not suggesting that the defense attorney is on.
What about the rebuttal comment?
Sorry, I'll pull it.
It's on page 25 of your brief, I think.
The rebuttal. Now, as the other prosecutor told you before she sat down, it's Mr. Stockman's job to get up here and go through mirrors and smoke screens. So what I'm going to do is go through everything he had to say to you and let you know that that's not what you heard. And I will tell you that our arguments are not evidence. Okay, you 12 collectively will make that decision. You 12 will talk about what you all remember hearing. Every single one of those exhibits with you. You'll have the jury instructions with you. Closing arguments are designed to let you know how you believe all the evidence fits together and whether you collectively fits together in that same way. It's not evidence. Some of the things I'll point them out. Mr. Stockman said to you, we'll have to recall was not the evidence. I guess when read in context, I think that still follows up on the fact that defense counsel was going to point out inconsistencies and the state disagreed with some of those inconsistencies that might have been pointed out. Their opinion didn't rise to the level. I still think that just went to the fact that the attorneys were commenting on the evidence. Read in context, not actually asserting that Nolan's trial counsel or defense attorneys in general are liars. It didn't rise to the level of the comments in Barfield. Had this court certainly could have found on direct appeal that it rose to the level of plain error as it did in Barfield. It didn't happen here.
So your position is it's not misconduct at all?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
The other three claims, the first of the other three relates to the failure to consult with and call an expert, a firearms expert. Mr. Nolan, his trial counsel should called an independent firearms expert to rebut the state's evidence that the bullets found at the murder scene consistent with having been fired from a .44 caliber firearm, which is the one found in the possession. We submit the record affirmatively refutes this claim for two reasons. First, even if Nolan's trial counsel had called an independent firearms expert, and if he or she had said that the bullets were not consistent with having been fired from a firearm such as the one found in his possession, not have undermined the state's case and would have created a battle with the experts, the issue with the state still could have and obviously would have argued that based on our expert, the bullets were consistent with having been fired from that weapon. And second, assuming for the sake of argument that an independent expert exclusively established that the bullets hadn't come from that gun, I mean, it still wouldn't have undermined the state's case, given that he wasn't apprehended until 8 days after the murder. Even if that weapon had conclusively been ruled out, it wouldn't have eliminated the fact that he could have used a different gun. Perhaps the 9mm found near the scene, perhaps another gun ditched or destroyed or just simply didn't have with him when he was arrested.
Do you read that claim as limited to an expert with respect to the .44?
Yes, I do. That's my reading.
Thank you.
What
did the expert say about the .44 found in the victim?
The state's expert testified that the bullets found at the scene were consistent with having been fired from a .44 caliber, such as the one found in Mr. Nolan's possession, but could not conclusively say that any of those bullets had actually been fired from that gun.
And was there a .44 in the victim, or...?
I don't recall. I think the bullets in the victim, if I recall the record correctly, were destroyed to the point that they couldn't tell for sure. Could be wrong on that. If I recall the expert's testimony, is that they were consistent with having been fired from that gun, and I don't recall if that's the victim versus the bullets found in the car. Not sure that I'm answering your question, but I don't recall, Your Honor.
Or if the record were to show that the state's witness would say that they couldn't be tied necessarily to the gun found on the defendant. What's to rebut?
Well, and that's the point I made in brief, that our evidence, even as presented under our own theory, was inconclusive. What is it? The other claims, there are two others. The first one is failure to object to Exhibits 169 and 170, photos of Nolan. Apparently while he was in police custody. Nolan claims his counsel should have objected to these, which he claims are mugshots from a prior unrelated arrest for theft. He argues in his reply brief that an evidentiary hearing should be granted on this issue so the district court can determine how the jury perceived those photographs and what impact they had on the jury. We maintain that the record affirmatively refutes this claim for two reasons. Number one, as set forth in our brief, the pictures were relevant to show that the description and identification of the state's witnesses were consistent with how Nolan looked, especially when, as the record reflects, Nolan was wearing glasses at trial, which would have given a different appearance than he had when the witnesses had seen him. Submit this random to pictures admissible under State v. Burge, and since they were admissible as trial counsel, was not in effect failing to object. And second, as set forth in our brief, submit that even if they were objectionable, there's no basis to conclude that the jury would have assumed they were pictures from a prior mugshot. Anything, they would have assumed that they were related to the arrest in this case, contrary to Nolan's assertion in his reply brief. Evidentiary hearing would be of no value on this issue because Rule 606 precludes us from getting into jury deliberations or the jury's thought process.
What claims do you concede should have an evidentiary hearing?
A, B, and C, the identification expert and fingerprint expert, and claim C is the failure to call Gwendolyn Anderson.
And you also concede that there were sufficient allegations of prejudice in the motion for post-conviction relief as to claims A, B, and C?
Yeah. The last claim I would address would be the fourth and final claim that the appellant has raised in his reply brief, or addressed in his reply brief, is the failure to object to the hearsay of Joseph Copeland. Claims his trial counsel should have objected to the testimony from Copeland about where his son found the 9mm gun, because it was inadmissible hearsay. That evidence had been objected to and excluded would have undermined the state's case. Submit the record affirmatively refutes this claim, because even if his counsel had objected to that evidence, it would not have been in the state's case, given that the 9mm was not tied directly to Taylor and Nolan, evidence of Taylor and Nolan's murder, testimony of the state's eyewitnesses, testimony of Joshua Kirchhoff, video footage of the gas station, fingerprints of Nolan found in the stolen vehicle in which Nolan Taylor had been in prior to the murder. Submit that this claim was properly denied. Further questions? Remaining claims of 9.5 hearing. Three seated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He is over.
There is no time for rebuttal. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is Smith versus Smith.